The Urbanist is brought to you in association with the Department of Culture and Tourism, Abu Dhabi. Saadiyat Cultural District, Abu Dhabi, is a beacon of hope and inspiration. A catalyst to spark growth and collaboration with museums and experiences, where art and science and nature and technology coexist.
The belief of Abu Dhabi that culture is the backbone of our society.
Stay tuned for a special episode of the show, in which you can hear His Excellency Mohammed Khalifa Al Mubarak explain exactly why and how Saadiyat Cultural District Abu Dhabi is the perfect place to collaborate, create and innovate. Saadiyat Cultural District Abu Dhabi, proud partner of The Urbanist on Monocle Radio.
Hello and welcome to The Urbanist, Monocle's programme all about the built environment. I'm your host, Andrew Tuck. Coming up...
It's a question of, can we see a vision for how we would reinvent this really into something that we would absolutely love to live or work in ourselves? I think that's the litmus test for every project we do.
We visit a newly transformed space in an old London department store. We're also in the Netherlands to see how the country is making use of their last building frontiers, the sky and the water. Plus, we speak with an expert in effective design of innovation spaces to see what they're doing right and also what they're doing wrong. That's ahead over the next 30 minutes right here on The Urbanist with me, Andrew Tuck. The furniture company Heels is a big part of the history of London. Having taken up shop in the 1800s, the Tottenham Court Road space is known for its spiral staircase and its resident cat, a stone one, and holds countless stories of manufacture, craft and retail in the city. Today, the retail space isn't quite as sprawling as it once was, and a recent transformation of the unused portions of the store by the firm General Projects will see a vast amount of office space become available in this historic building. I recently went for a tour of the newly transformed Heels and sat down for a chat with General Projects CEO Jacob Loftus, where I began by asking about his firm and why they certainly aren't just looking for easy wins when it comes to real estate.
We are definitely not looking for the easy wins. We look to make our lives as complicated and difficult as possible by trying to buy sometimes unloved, sometimes misunderstood, always very complicated buildings that we think have the potential to become interesting, exciting, innovative, creative buildings that ultimately we can redesign and reinvent entirely around the end user who's going to engage with it. I think real estate is kind of the only industry in the world where people create something that they don't think of as a product and don't really prioritize designing it around the needs of the end user. People tend to follow a formula in this industry. And for us, it's about creating a user experience in everything we do.
Now, we're on Tottenham Court Road. Tottenham Court Road, for people who are not London, is right in the heart of London, runs down to Oxford Street, was traditionally known as a home for furniture stores. And it still is, this building on the ground floor, home to one of the most famous tenants of this street, Heels. Tell us about this building or this multitude of buildings and how you found them.
Heels, as you say, is one of the UK's most well-known and iconic furniture businesses. They started life here in the 1800s doing two things. They had a series of workshops and smaller buildings at the back of the site, which they manufactured all of their furniture from cabinets to beds to sofas and curtains. And then at the front of the block facing Tottenham Court Road, they built a very grand, beautiful department store. And as time has evolved, they stopped manufacturing from here, but still continued very much selling from here. And we got an opportunity a couple of years ago to be able to buy the entirety of the site. So the grand department store at the front and this collection of amazing old industrial warehouse and workshop buildings at the back. And the vision we're hopefully going to be able to execute is to transform what was a building that kind of stood for the best of British design furniture making for the last 100 years, hopefully transform it into a building that will still very much be a home for Heels, but also can become a home to a variety of different office users, hopefully all of whom share that same British spirit of design, creativity and innovation. And hopefully we can create this lovely urban campus, stitching all of these buildings together and bringing a really cool and creative, diverse community into it.
As we walked around the site, it's going to be home to a lot of companies. I believe almost a dozen are already signed up or already here. And Heels have moved, they were on two floors, they've moved down to the ground floor. There was some vacant space there as well. What's your logic of how the building is going to work? What's it going to do?
So I think the starting point for us was we wanted to ensure that anything we were going to do with this building would ensure that the Heels business would remain at the heart of it. I think there are a lot of stories going on at the moment around department stores being redeveloped, retail businesses having to close. Obviously, the high street's a tough sector. And I think for us, the idea of the Heels building without Heels didn't sit right. So the very first thing we did was spend time with Heels as a business, understand what they needed and how could we create a new home for them within the building that would stand the test of time and enable them to be here for the next 100 years. There was some empty retail space at ground floor, and for us, we thought the whole of the Tottenham Court Road frontage has got to be Heels. So the anchor of this project and the North Star heart will always be Heels being in the ground and basement and having this amazing furniture emporium. The rest of the building is much more around the future of work and trying to create a range of different, unusual, characterful, creative offices like the one we're sitting in now, which is all about trying to embrace the history and culture and quirks of this building, because it is a very quirky and unusual building. No two spaces are the same, and trying to just embrace that to create a variety of different shapes and sizes to allow cool, interesting businesses to have a home that they're inspired by and absolutely love coming to every day.
Well, as you walked us around, there are courtyard gardens, there are roof gardens, there are light wells, there are unusual spaces, there's definitely stairs up and down between levels. 2-3 years ago, even here in London, people would have been cautious about a big bet on new office space. But the story is getting quite interesting now that, especially here in the centre of London, it feels like many people want to relocate here from what was thought to be the cooler neighbourhoods a little bit further out. What's the story that you're seeing about office space? Because obviously this is a brave move, or is it actually just you're anticipating what the market's going to look like?
We're incredibly confident and excited about the project, so we don't see it as brave at all. We think it's quite an obvious move. I'm sure there are probably a lot of other people who didn't see it that way and definitely think it's a bit brave, but that's probably the same thing most people would say about most of our projects. In reality, we don't necessarily take the traditional, well-trodden path.
But the trend, you see the trend as returning to office space?
I think the world has very much accepted that the questions around work from home and what would happen post-pandemic, we have moved back to a physical working environment. People want to collaborate, they want to be creative, they want to engage with the teams that they work with and their colleagues. So I think the future of work is definitely in person, albeit with a lot more flexibility and the ability to work from home here and there when you need it, because that's the environment we're in. But I think most companies are now focused on how do we create and foster an environment that is inspiring to our staff, that gets people talking, that makes them feel creative, that makes them want to come to the office. Because we all know that if we need to, we can sit at home in front of a screen, conduct video calls for 12 hours a day and can get by without coming to the office. So the need to come to the office needs to be a desire, and to create that desire and allow people to be at their best and be most productive and be collaborative is hopefully by being in amazing spaces that instigate that and drive that natural reaction. And that's what we're trying to create.
I've heard the phrase a little bit over the last few weeks about buildings that earn the commute, that you can't have a dull building, expect people to rock up and be joyful when they come through the front door. What is it about old buildings? Because it's fascinating, isn't it, that when you think about all these cool young companies starting up, they don't seek out the most slick, modern offices usually. They like places with some kinks and quirks and heritage. Is that something that you feel underpins the kind of market that you're going for?
Definitely. Almost all the projects that we're involved in as a business are taking old industrial, Victorian, historic buildings and trying to repurpose them into interesting new places. And I think there's a sense of character, authenticity, creativity that naturally is created by repurposing an old building that's very hard to replicate in a new building, particularly the traditional conventional glass and steel rectangular boxes that have characterized the way we've worked for the last 40 or 50 years. But I think that is changing, and in today's world, there's something a lot more inspiring and also comforting. It feels warm and nice to be in an old building, whereas it feels quite clinical and uninspiring to be in a lot of the newer buildings that are created. But that's not to say that new buildings can't achieve what old buildings are. I think it's just, it's not the way the industry and the world has evolved them. But I think that potentially could start to change quite soon too.
Tell me, not everyone's going to be able to rent an office or visit their friends here, but you have an interesting yard or lane in front of the building, which was used for deliveries. And you said it used to manufacture lots of stuff here. So it was carting furniture out from the workshops and things. This could be a new little piece of public realm for London as well. Explain to us what you'd like to do.
So just off Tottenham Court Road, there's a quaint little mews called Alfred Mews, which for the last 100 years has been a loading, servicing bay that took you to nowhere. We've repurposed all of the historic loading bays and all of the servicing areas of the building into retail, a new lobby, a cafe, and we're working quite hard to completely reimagine that mews as a new kind of found happening little hidden side street in the heart of Fitzrovia that hopefully in the coming months we'll have some interesting restaurants opening there, and hopefully we can bring that to life. So already your first interaction with the building can hopefully come from a much more exciting and experiential environment. But we also don't want to create an office building that isn't open to the public. So Heels has got such an important history in so many people's lives. You know, I think I've probably met 100 people in the last year working on this project who told me they did their wedding registry at Heels. And so coming to this building, you know, is part of key milestones for a lot of people. So whilst the department store's downsized, we want to make sure that a lot of the building still feels publicly accessible. So we've put in a new cafe, our lobby area, the courtyards are all connected to the store. Someone who's shopping in the store can wander through the new parts of the building that we've created at the ground floor. And I think some in the office world might naturally say, well, how does it work for an office business upstairs? Do they really want people wandering through the lobby and through the ground floor? But we don't see that as a negative. We want to bring an energy, you know, a hotel lobby sort of environment, a kind of public dynamic to this building, because we think it creates an atmosphere and an energy and a level of excitement that, you know, make it a place you want to be and want to work in.
My conversation with General Projects CEO Jacob Loftus there, and my thanks to him. Next, we head to the Netherlands, which is coping with its worst housing crisis ever. 1 million houses are needed to be built before the end of 2030, or around 2,500 new homes every week. But as the country is already one of the most densely populated in the world, space is limited, with only two places where the Dutch can still build: in the sky or on the water. Dozens of high-rises are under construction or planned, transforming cities such as Rotterdam and The Hague into minor versions of Manhattan, while other architects are increasingly preparing for rising sea levels with floating homes. Some projects even combine both, such as Rotterdam, which is reclaiming land from the water to build skyscrapers. To tell us more, Stefan de Vries sent us this report.
If cities had a soundtrack, Parisians would listen to cliched accordions. Venice's music would feature the sound of water and singing gondoliers. And Rotterdam's? Well, in that Dutch city, the soundtrack would be dominated by the constant pounding of piles. They go 60 meters deep into the ground and are the foundations of buildings that would otherwise sink into the slack and wet Dutch soil. Rotterdam's building boom had a sad beginning. In May 1940, almost the entire historic city centre was destroyed in just a few hours by a bombing raid by the Nazis. Despite this trauma, the city began plans for rebuilding less than 4 days after its destruction. Rather than reconstructing it in the typical 17th century Dutch style as the city was, they chose to modernise it. Europe's largest port has since become a laboratory for modern architecture, where star architects such as Norman Foster, Helmut Jahn and Rem Koolhaas have made their mark. A new generation now joins these household names. One of them is Nanne de Ru, founder of Powerhouse Company, with offices in Rotterdam, Oslo and Munich. As an architect, developer and builder, he designs a large number of projects in Europe, including many residential towers. So why are these high-rises so popular in the Netherlands in particular? we ask Nana de Rue.
I think that there's one reason is that people are more and more living in smaller households. So the household size is decreasing. And that also means that the typical row house, which is very much a family house, is more and more complemented also by apartments, also for a single use. So especially in the cities, the rise of the apartments is definitely a very big factor. And the other thing we're dealing with is that we have a huge housing shortage and a lot of pressure on the green countryside in between the cities. So densification of the city is a very logical and necessary step. And for cities like Rotterdam, which already have an experience with high rise and which also have the urbanistic, let's say, possibilities for high rise, the densification in the forms of towers is extremely appealing. For a long time, Rotterdam really suffered from a lack of any liveliness in the city center. And ever since the city started to develop more high rises for living in the city center, the urban life and the quality of the city life really improved massively. So I think when you look at sustainability and also, let's say, cultural intensity, the addition of more high rises is a great improvement for urban life.
But what is it like to actually live in one of those many towers? Monocle visited Wendy Buiter, a successful artist who paints very colorful portraits. She lives and works on the 19th floor of the Salmon Harbour Tower, at 190 meters, currently the tallest in the Benelux countries.
I live here since 2 years. I got in March 2022, so it's 2 years now.
And how do you like it so far?
I like it very much. It's a wonderful place to live and the building is very nice and my apartment's very spacious and light. So I really love it. I really love the architecture. I really love the style the building is built in, the colors of the stones they used. So you could see this building in New York, for example, and I really love that sort of design.
Are there also things that are maybe less convenient of living in a very high building?
Yes, I think you always have to wait when it's busy in the elevator, for example, or there are on a windy day, the wind blows to the building and, you know, it's not that bad when it's just a day, but in the winter, day after day, it's really noisy. So that's not so nice, but well, I think there are more good things about it than bad things about it.
Wendy Buiter is no exception. In the flat Dutch countryside, few places are left where towers are not visible on the horizon. The Hague and Rotterdam have skylines rarely seen in Europe, while Amsterdam, Utrecht and Eindhoven are also building more and more towers above 100 meters. It is not a fashion trend, but a pure necessity. The housing shortage in the Netherlands has been declared a national crisis. Amsterdam, Rotterdam and The Hague are already among the top 5 priciest European cities in which to rent a house. The Dutch population is expected to grow from 18 million now to 20 million in the next 15 years. And the government wants to build 1 million new houses. However, with a density of 530 inhabitants per square kilometer, more than double that of the UK, there is little room left. There are only two options: to build in the sea, which is also happening with the construction of polders, or in the sky. Over the next few years, Rotterdam alone will get 50 new towers above 70 meters. One of the most striking projects is the Rijnhaven, the Rhine Harbour, a former harbour now being developed into a new second city centre of Rotterdam. It should become a lively district for some 8,000 new residents, with theatres, shops, a new park and a city beach. Nana de Rue and his firm also designed part of this new area.
The Rijnhaven is, I think, a very interesting place in Rotterdam because it was the first, let's say, modern harbour of Rotterdam. At the time it was completed, it was also the largest harbour in Rotterdam. And that's 100 years ago. And I think already 30 or 40 years ago, it was abandoned because it had become too small and too central in the city, too close to actually urban life. And the harbour moved out towards the ocean. But what's interesting about the Rijnhaven is that it is actually quite a beautiful water basin that is now partly being reclaimed again as land. And that area will turn into a very large park with towers around it. And all the old factories that used to be around the Rijnhaven have all left except two that are still here now. And one of them is an area that we are redeveloping into a project called the Codrico Terrain, where we will develop a total of 1,500 housing units and offices and also cultural functions.
back to Wendy Bouter in a new apartment overlooking the metropolis. Her non-obstructed view will change dramatically in the coming years.
I love, like, for example, how the city of New York looks like, and I think Rotterdam can be like that too in the future. I'm very excited how this city will look like in 50 years or maybe 100 years from now. I know there are many other high rises coming up. Maybe they're higher than this one, I believe so, but yeah, I think it's nice. Although the view might be getting obstructed, I don't mind, because I think overall the city will be more exciting.
Rotterdam will probably never be finished. For over 80 years, Europe's largest port has been an architectural mecca, where the rhythm of the pounding piles defines its soundtrack well into the decades to come. For Monocle in Rotterdam, I'm Stefan de Vries.
My thanks to Stefan de Vries there. Finally today, I'm joined by Anouk Brown, the founder of Natural Networks, a consultancy dedicated to helping build environments that promote meaningful connections and co-nurture innovation. Anouk has visited innovation hubs and community spaces all over Europe to collect data on best practices in interior design based on cultural differences and engagement, programming, and also the curation of communities. Well, Anouk, thank you very much for joining us. Now, can we start with some basics? Can you tell us, first of all, how you define an innovation hub?
For me, this is, first of all, a physical hub, talking about a space that can be between 200 to 20,000 square meters or even more. In Switzerland, it's right now 70 hectares where people come together in order to innovate. I've seen a lot of those spaces and I've visited a lot in Europe. So it can be starting off from a university like ETH in Switzerland, for example, where they start a hub. But it can also be a company like Google who starts an innovation center. Or if we go into pharma, it can be like Novartis in Basel who has an innovation center. So it can be started from a city, an academia, a company. And then more and more stakeholders have to grow together and come together to collaborate around those topics.
Now, you have a company, Natural Networks, that looks at these hubs, and you've been doing a huge amount of research. You've been visiting as many as you can, collecting data, trying to work out what works and doesn't work. And I know that you're still sceptical the ideal one has been built at this stage. What are the things that, first of all, make them work? What do you need to make these places sticky, successful, attractive for people to go to?
So I have visited over 60 hubs in Europe now. So I have a lot of data that I collected. And what I see is that the best way to really create a successful and sustainable innovation hub is placemaking as a methodology. So putting together what kind of infrastructure and design do you need, but then also thinking about what kind of people do I need in this space in order to be able to collaborate. Just imagine you have 90 consultants. Innovation will not be happening. But if you have a very diverse group of people, not just from race and sex, but also profession and industry level, that's where the beauty and the magic happens in innovation. And at the same time, you need programming. So you can have beautiful design, but if you don't know how to activate those people in a room, you will never have a successful business case. And that's, I think, the last hook, is that people always try to have beautiful spaces and a lot of people in it, but they forget the commercial side. How do I make it profitable? Because in the end, it's a business. And I think those are the four things that have to come together in order to be a successful hub.
So just to unpack that a little. So you can have the coolest space. You mm-hmm. can have 90 cool people. Mm-hmm. But unless somebody is setting up some triggers that start interactions, you could have 90 people sitting with their headphones on doing their own thing.
Exactly. You need kind of an orchestrator, someone who understands what are their needs and their interests from each stakeholder and each person, user in the space, and then find the right trigger points in regards to programming. So what kind of events do you need? You need parties for people to meet on a human level. You need content events for knowledge transfer. But you also need spaces that foster serendipity. I think the most popular space for this is the coffee machine by now, or even the toilet situation you have. Funny enough, we found out that one of the spaces did an amazing job for people to actually meet in the toilet and from there move to collaborating on innovation projects. It was insane.
Who knew it began in the bathroom? But tell me, so why on earth did you become interested in collecting data on these hubs? What was your starting point?
Funny enough, I started my career as a concierge in Dubai in the luxury hotelery. I was always fascinated by observing people in space and by collaboration and how people interact with each other. And then I started in Berlin at Factory Berlin, and I learned not just how people interact, but how do I get them to interact? What kind of environment do I have to find in order for people to start talking? And what I found super interesting is the most amazing conversations were people that came from arts and then from pharma. They were so far from each other and they would have never met if I didn't have put them on a table. And that's when innovation started. And that's when I got very interested in what kind of space and programming do you need for different people who in a normal world would never meet. How do I get them together in order to bring something beautiful in innovation?
So from your experience in hospitality, because, you know, it's a sector we often look at with interest because there seems to be lots of life skills learned there that can help all sorts of industries. And we have people in this building who we have snapped up from hospitality because it's such an interesting training. But do the roles, for example, of, you know, the host, the concierge, it sounds like when we get a bit caught up on, you know, somebody programming a space is doing, that maybe the life skills from this world of hospitality, there's a bit of a transferable skill there.
Yeah, there's a huge overlap in skills. I always told the innovation hubs to hire people from hospitality because they are hosts by heart. They are very genuine. They're very good in reflective listening because that's what you're trained for. They're very observant and they genuinely are interested in people. And I think that's what you need in order to have a successful orchestrator in a space. People who are interested in learning, what are your needs? Who do you want to meet? Because in innovation, you always are looking for three things. You either need ideas, you need talent, or you need projects and customers. And it's always those three things. So the community manager or the concierge, he's the one talking to the people, finding out what they need. So soft skills are huge.
So you have these pillars you believe in for each of these spaces. How easy is it for somebody to implement that? If they want to think, okay, I have got this great space, but it's not quite working. You come along and say, you know, you need design, you need programming, you need a collective identity. Can you give now people off the back of your research a format that they can begin to use as a template for initiating those things?
First of all, you're never a standalone solution. So if you have a building, you're always part of an ecosystem of a city, a neighborhood. So make sure to look at what is needed, what kind of people do you have in the area that you can bring into your space to collaborate? And what is your strategy? What is the actual purpose that you want to achieve? Because that's what most of the innovation centers are lacking. And understand if you want to build a community or network, there's a huge difference. A community has a shared value and a shared mission and goals, and you curate people, whereas a network is a loose group of people coming together for events. And then secondly, find the right trigger points and hooks for people to be interested to come back to your space. And it's mostly the programming, what kind of events, what kind of hospitality, like food and beverage, the best talks and the best conversations are always held over food or nice drinks. So make sure you have a good balance of all those different facilities and services in a building that are answering the needs of your target group. Make sure you understand who is in the building.
Tell me, when you turn up with your clipboard, are people pleased to see you? Are they, do they see you as a, you used the word agnostic earlier on, maybe that's a good word, that somebody comes in who's data collecting, or do they realise that you're trying to raise the bar?
No, I think they appreciate that I've seen so much in Europe already. I bring a lot of ideas from other hubs and I have best practices that I'm happy to share because I think that innovation hubs in general are so necessary for our world and for a lot of the cities. They're the hook why people will come to the city and why they stay relevant. So I do have good conversations and mostly people are smiling even when I leave the building afterwards. So I think it's good.
And tell me, you don't believe the ideal one is out there yet. What do people miss in the equation?
It's always something different. Sometimes there are amazing examples out there in Lisbon, like Second Home. They have great design and it's amazing infrastructure and they understand community building, but they don't really know how to do programming. Or you have a great community and they lack the design that's actually making the space profitable. So if you think about only 42% of those spaces are actually profitable and everyone else is struggling commercially and financially, I think that's the biggest struggle they have. They don't really understand to think beyond their four walls of physical space on how to monetize innovation and community building. And most of the time, that's what's missing. The how do I expand my portfolio besides just renting a space or selling a membership.
You're based in Switzerland, in Zurich, and you know, as you mentioned earlier on, there's universities like ETH or ETH that have done incredibly well at being a bit of a European MIT in some ways. How are they doing? How's your home market doing?
I think they're pretty good. I'm right now supporting the Switzerland Innovation Park in Zurich, and ETH is the founding member of it. And I think they have the right vision. What they need is more support from the industry. So they have all the knowledge, and now it's about how do we commercialize all the R&D we're doing at university. And I think that's where they're looking for more support from the industry, getting all the knowledge they have into real businesses and then out of Switzerland as well.
And finally, just tell us if someone is listening in now and they have an innovation hub or they believe that their city needs one to function better as a cradle of creativity and knowledge, what should their starting point be? What should they think about?
Think about who they want to collaborate with in the area they're at. An innovation space is never done by just a single party. So you always need the five stakeholders. You always need the government. You always need corporates. You need talents in regards to startups. You need the financial sector and you need academia. Make sure you have all those five people at the table in order to start an innovation hub.
Anouk Brown there. Thank you for joining me here on The Urbanist. And that's all for this week's episode of the show. Make sure you stay up to date with the newest episode every week. Just follow or subscribe to us through your favourite podcast platform or, of course, via monocle.com. The Urbanist is produced by Carlotta Ribello and by David Stevens, who also edits the show. I'm Andrew Tuck. Goodbye, and thank you for listening, City Lovers.